Into the Weird, episode 35, Who Watches the Watcher?
Welcome to Into the Weird, a podcast celebrating the madness and the magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age. I'm your host, Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, Herman Lowe. How are you, Herman?
Hey, Billy man. I'm great, as always. When we're doing podcasting, I can't complain, you know, because it's the highlight of my week. Sometimes several highlights, since you and I are doing multiple recordings each week now. We really do have way too much time on our hands.
Yeah, I think somebody said, when do you guys sleep? And I said, never.
Yeah, never. No, if there's comics involved, we'd rather read than sleep. And if there's podcasting involved, mm-hmm. I'd rather fall asleep in front of the mic than on my bed. So, yeah, mm-hmm. We're dedicated.
Absolutely.
Before we start this episode, Billy, I have a question for you. A very, very important question. Very difficult to answer. Who watches The Watcher? Think about that. In the Marvel Universe, and lately, who watches The Watcher?
Oh, wait a minute. It's probably the government. They watch everybody. Oh, wait.
Big Brother watches The Watcher. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm saying, you know, we're going to be watching The Watcher today because we're going to be reading some what-if comics. And, you know, obviously, millions of Disney Plus subscribers are watching The Watcher these days. He's become a celebrity.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Even though he's kind of a dick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a knucklehead. But isn't he dead now in continuity? Didn't somebody shoot him?
Yeah, well, it happened in a crossover event written by Jason Aaron. My favorite character, the Orb, was involved, and the Orb ended up stealing the Watcher's eye. But, you know, I didn't actually read that. I think Grant, you know, recommended that to me. And then, unfortunately, I wasn't on Marvel at the time. You know, the Marvel Unlimited app, I just stopped my subscription and, various other reasons. I couldn't get my comics here. Eventually, I resubscribed to Comixology, but then I decided not to pick it up. I just saw the images, you know, on the on the web. I know Jason Aaron is almost as big an Orb fan as I am. But
that's great.
Not quite, yeah. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, Nick Fury ended up with the Eye of the Watcher later on. I'm not quite sure, but, you know, he needs an extra eye, right? So
yeah, he needs some help, yeah.
Great that they're using the Watcher so much these days too. I always like the whole conceit of what if, you know, that the Watcher is bored or something and he's, you know, not just focusing on watching the Marvel 616 universe, he also branches out. It's kind of like interdimensional cable. You know, if you've ever watched Rick and Morty, you know, Rick the scientist grandpa and Morty his little kid that tags along with him. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've watched that cartoon, Rick in a few episodes he hooks them up with interdimensional cable so they can watch cable across the multiverse. And this is kind of what the Watcher is doing, you know, except he's using his omniscience rather than, you know, a cable system that he's hooked up to a TV. But I've liked that premise. What do you think about What If, Billy? I mean, let's get into this. Well, like, what's your history with the title, specifically Volume 1 from 1977 to 84.
Yeah, I mean, the one we're going to cover that, you know, I brought to the table today, that may have been my first issue of What If ever. And I just have, you know, a random few issues of it. I'm big, like, especially when I was, you know, younger, I was more into books that had, you know, continuity and the same characters from, you know, month to month and stuff like that. So I was never really, like, huge into What If. Just, you know, if I saw the odd random issue and it had, you know, somebody on the cover that I really loved, like Doctor Strange, I would buy those. But that was the extent of it. I bought, you know, a couple Doctor Strange and a couple this and that, and then the one we're gonna lead off with here, this one I could not pass up.
Definitely not, Ben, and we'll get into why just now. But we're gonna save the Doctor Strange What Ifs for a later date, right? We've said we're gonna use that to extend our regular Doctor Strange coverage. But yeah, I ended up, you know, fairly early on in my collecting career with the entire run of Volume 1 of What If. And I think the reason for that is because whoever else was buying comics in South Africa in my small town other than myself, and there weren't many people at all, almost nil, almost zero people, but, you know, whoever was, you know, they probably took the Spider-Mans, the Justice Leagues, the, you know, the Avenger comics. So I could never get those on the regular, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But with What If, they were always on the shelf. They weren't loved by whatever other South African comic collector, you know, existed in my small town. So I picked up the whole run. They had them in batches sometimes available on the spinner racks. They you know, every time they restocked the spinner racks, there would be a couple of What If issues. You know, so eventually I ended up with all, but you know, to complete the entire run, I did eventually have to go to comic stores once they became a thing around 1986, 1987 in South Africa. But, you know, then I found the remaining issues there. So I got all 47 issues of Volume 1. But it turns out that Volume 2, you know, believe which ran from, I think, 1989 to about 1994. That was the most successful and long running volume of What If. Because I never read any of those. I don't know if you did, but
I never
picked them up. It's not that I didn't see them on the shelves. I probably just didn't like the cover art or something, and I was, you know, into Vertigo at the time. You know, I was trying to be pretentious and read more adult fare and all of that. But I soon gravitated back to our beloved superheroes. But still, you know, so Volume 2, I'm not, you know, clued up on. But there's been, you know, more than 10 volumes of What If to date. And, you know, well, most of them were one-shots, you know, after Volume 2 ended. But still, What If's a highly regarded and successful series for Marvel. And, you know, it all started with Roy the Boy Thomas. That was his brainchild. He came up with the What If series in the 1970s for Marvel. And in 1977, it launched. And Roy's idea behind it was inspired by Stan Lee, when Stan Lee used to coach him into, you know, generating stories in the 60s and early 70s. Stan would say, you know, just think about a What If situation. That's all Stan Lee's Fantastic Four stories, for instance, is What If, you know. To a certain extent, of course, limited by the universe that he and Jack had already established. But for Roy, he took it further, you know, and then, you know, they just ran with it. So they got the Watcher as the narrator of the series, and I think that was a stroke of genius. I'd always liked the whole story behind the Watchers, you know, that they were this all-powerful race who just as powerful as the Celestials or Galactus, but they had screwed up, you know, eons ago by helping out other races, but then, you know, giving a certain alien race the secrets of atomic technology or atomic power, and then that race ended up destroying themselves. So the Watchers vowed after that never to interfere again, and they would simply record and watch events as they unfold. So I like that. And you know, then Roy has gone on record, and the rest of the Marvel as well has gone on record as stating that it is not just they are not imaginary tales, these What If stories. They're actually part of a multiverse. So, Billy, we know DC had the monopoly on the multiverse for a while there, right? If you think about, you know, the early 60s when Barry Allen, the Flash, first met Jay Garrick, and that kicked off the whole DC multiverse universe, multiple universes, where the Justice League and the Justice Society had their annual crossovers and all of that. Superman mm-hmm. went into different dimensions too at times, where he met other Supermen, farm boys that he had to coach. And, you know, of course, they have their Elseworlds that eventually, you know, came out of their whole multiverse system. And now we've got the multiverse back in DC. But, you know, I think the Marvel multiverse is more cohesive, and that's why they have a animated series now on Disney Plus. And, in fact, yeah. Billy, that's the reason you and I are doing this particular show today, because we're trying to, you know, hop on the bandwagon here of, you know, the popularity of What If.
Yeah, so it was a great thing for, you know, Roy, a good job by Roy and, you know, the people doing the television show. It's, you know, they're not stupid. They're pretty smart. So, you know, they saw this property here and thought, hey, let's go for it.
Yeah, and now it's very successful. It's doing really well. Mm-hmm. I've watched all five of the episodes they've put out so far, thanks to my in-laws still keeping their Disney Plus. You know, it's good. It's great. So far, very good episodes. The Doctor Strange episode is my least favorite, but you know, we'll talk more on that during Shop Talk. And yeah, so great times, you know, for What If, and that's why there's also an omnibus available now. What If Volume 1 omnibus. I think it collects the first like 24 issues of What If, and then there's a second one, you know, slated for release in November, and that will collect the entire Volume 1. And then you've also got the, some trade paperbacks, you know, the What If, the complete collection. I think they've got two out. I don't know, they're still available, but you can find everything on the Marvel Unlimited app or Comixology in any case. So read along with us if you can, listeners. Now, Billy, I want to ask you particularly, first off, you're going to go first, because chronologically in Volume 1 that we're discussing, your issue comes first. So you're going to give us the details on that issue and then the synopsis. And then I'm going to go with the very next issue. So you're going to be doing What If Volume 1, Issue 11, and I'm going to be doing Issue 12. So that's going to be interesting. They have nothing to do with each other, though.
No, not at all.
They're complete universes apart, literally. All right, Billy, let it roll. Give us some details on your particular issue. And maybe you should start with the synopsis you can go with later.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, so this is, like you said, What If number 11 from 1978, and it's Jack Kirby, writer, artist, you know, slash penciler and editor. And then Mike Royer, inks and letters, which is a real treat there. Carl Gafford on colors, and Roy Thomas is the series editor. So, you know, some real heavyweights there.
That's right, that's right. And what be the synopsis? I think the synopsis is tied in with the title of the comic.
Yeah, the synopsis and the title are the same thing. What if the Fantastic Four were the original Marvel bullpen?
That's right. That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know. There's, so listeners, there's no real synopses this episode, because we'd be giving too much away. And this, you know, what if scenario sums up the whole issue brilliantly. So Billy, let's quickly run through. Well, before we get into the issue, we should mention that good on Roy for getting Jack Kirby, who did everything in this issue, penciling, inking, everything, writing. He got him back to do the Fantastic Four again. And you know, Jack, he said he wouldn't do the Fantastic Four again after he left in 1970. When he came back to Marvel in the mid-70s after his fantastic stint at DC, which wasn't financially successful for DC, but it was, you know, immensely successful in the creative realm, if you think about all the ideas he generated there for DC. But when he came back to Marvel, they said, do you want to do the Fantastic Four again? In fact, they gave him carte blanche. He could do almost anything. And he said, no, he doesn't want to do the Fantastic Four again. Sorry. maybe too many bad memories associated with it, or he wanted to try something new, you know, so they allowed him to create some new series, got on Captain America again, and so forth. But Roy somehow got him back in 1977, or I should say this was 1978 already, to do a Fantastic Four comic again. But it's not quite the Fantastic Four we know, right, Billy? Who are the characters? Who are the original Marvel bullpen?
Yeah, so you have Smilin' Stan Lee as Mr. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then we have Jolly Jack Kirby as the Thing, chomping on a cigar and everything while he's punching and flailing about. And then Fabulous Flo Steinberg, she's the Invisible Woman. And then Saul Brodsky is the Human Torch.
Wow. Okay, mm-hmm. I could see Stan, Jack, and Flo obviously fitting into those roles. Saul Brodsky as the Human Torch. I don't know if you want a production manager to be flammable or to be, you know, to combust every now and then. You know, you're going to ruin some great copy there. But still, they were the original Marvel bullpen, you know. So Flo being Stan's secretary, she was kind of invisible. No, not really. Stan made her very visible, you know, because he sort of gave everybody a personality in the comics. All the people working behind the scenes, readers knew who they were, right? So, And this is a fantastic issue by Kirby. The pencils are off the charts. What do you think, Billy? He did an amazing job.
Oh, my gosh. Whew. Yeah, I mean, when didn't he? You know what I mean? Like, especially once you got into, you know, this era, like you said, the fourth world of DC, and then coming back over here. To me, everything he did in that era is just gold. It's perfect. And again, when he has a great inker too, like Mike Royer, he did a fantastic job in some of that fourth world material, and then, you know, came over here and did some of these too. Like, I think he did some Machine Man maybe with Kirby as well.
Mike Royer
looks fantastic.
Yeah, Mike Royer, definitely. Joe Sinnott, number one. Yeah. But Mike Royer, a very close second. Very close second. And yes. I'm going to go on record here as saying that, you know, Kirby in the 70s is my favorite Kirby. But, you know, I love 60s Kirby as well. Fantastic issues on Thor that I absolutely adore. Of course, the Fantastic Four stuff is, you know, incomparable. You can't really go wrong with that. But I would have to... My favorite era of Kirby was the 70s when he was allowed to write his own stuff. Right, Billy? That was when we got the good ideas and the crazy, wacky concepts that he generated. But he also did that in the 1960s. But I think, of course, Stan restrained him a little, you know, with the Marvel method, which worked great for someone like Kirby. But he had some parameters. But in the 70s, he just went crazy. And there were no borders. I mean, no source walls. Well, there was a source wall, but that didn't stop him, right?
Yeah, he was able to write, edit, and pencil his own stuff, which was great.
That's right. Now, let's talk about the cover first, Billy. Like, I really, really like this cover, especially the Marvel Corner Books art, where you got, you know, Saul, Jack, Stan, and Flo. And and he drew them very accurately. You can really see, if you look at photos and black and white images from that time, you can really see Saul's face in the Human Torch, Flo looking like Flo. And, of course, Stan, Jack has caricatured him so much. You know, especially with, you know, when he did the funky Flashman, you know, character over at DC, where he parodied Stan Lee. And, you know, Jack looks like Jack as the Thing. It's amazing.
He does. Yeah, it's great. It's very good likenesses. And then you got some kind of crazy fourth world-esque, you know, monster here growling at them. And Saul Brodsky, a.k.a. the Human Torch, throwing his fire, saying, "Stan, even my fireballs won't stop that monster." And Stan says, "Keep trying, Saul. Come on, Jack, Flo." And then Kirby's getting a fist ready, and he says, "Right, it's real life clobbering time."
Real life clobbering time. And we know Jack Kirby could clobber a fella if he wanted to. You know, he was a tough guy. Grew up on the mean streets, right, of New York, you know, in the 1920s, even, you know, so... You don't want to mess with Jack. I mean, didn't he once famously, you know, when he was working on comics in the 1940s, some Nazi sympathizer showed up you know, to straighten Jack out because of the whole, you know, him creating Captain America. And then he went downstairs to straighten them out.
Yeah, he was anybody that fought in World War II, that they need your respect.
Yeah. And this was even before that. So, you know, after he came back from World War II, I'd say he was even tougher.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to piss him off in his heyday.
No way, dude. So, you know, the cover's great, and then you turn the first page, and then there's a fantastic opening page. And we've got the Fantastic Four squaring off here in some kind of a cave system against this... it's a very, very typical Kirby-looking caveman-like monster. You know, he looks similar to Kalibak or to Blastar, you know.
Like a troll or ogre type.
Yeah, troll-like monster there, but he's got this sci-fi looking club, which spews energy. So yes, he's a caveman monstrosity, but he does have this sci-fi club with him, and the Fantastic Four are taking him on. And we've got the Watcher photobombing the Fantastic Four there on the bottom panel. What do you say about that, buddy?
Oh yeah. He looks as crazy as ever too, with his gigantic bald head poking in there to tell us what's going on, sort of be mysterious as usual. And then he's the first thing you see the next page over, you flip to, and he's goes on his little soliloquy about how this being a duplicate Earth and different people in the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this is not our Earth. This is definitely also one of the Marvel universes, because the Submariner, we'll see later on, is alive and well in this Earth. But technically, Stan and the entire Marvel bullpen, they did appear in the regular Marvel 616 universe in the comics a lot. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. The X-Men, the Avengers, I think. Yeah, they were in a bunch of comics. Yep.
So this is not, you know, inconceivable. And, of course, they were characters. Stanley created or turned them all into characters, you know, the people behind the scenes. And, and it just makes sense that they would do this. So, you know, of course. This comic then, you know, just steamrolls because it's Kirby, right? Billy, there's no, you don't get a chance to catch a breath because after the Watcher introduces the players, Stan, you know, the editor, Saul Brodsky, the VP, Stan's second in command, Jack, the hardworking artist, Flo, the secretary without peer. We get into the next the next page, which is the third page, where this Blastar caveman troll just blasts Mr. Fantastic and the Thing into unconsciousness. And then who takes him out in the battle?
Flo here takes him out. She turns invisible, and then she uses her smarts here. Instead of being a goon like the guys, they sort of try to punch the guy. Well, she figures out if I put him inside my force field, and then the guy, you know, discharges the weapon and kind of like implodes inside the Thing. There's like feedback and just knocks himself completely out.
Our force shields come to the rescue. And, you know, I think Jack portrayed Flo very well in this comic. Flo definitely is the one who saves them at multiple points in the story. And also she is presented as the more rational of the bunch, I think. Whereas the boys are wrapped up in their own worries, or in Stan's case, in his own ego. Or and then... You know, I think, I don't know if Kirby ever had a thing for Flo. Obviously, he was in love with Roz. She was his one and only. But I think, you know, I mean, there's a couple of scenes in this comic where, I mean, Flo calls Kirby handsome at one point in time. And, you know, he treats her really well in this issue as well. Very respectfully, and gives her a lot of screen time. What do you think?
Yeah, and I like how she calls the Brodsky and Lee and...
and himself and Kirby
and Jack. She calls them she calls them boys all the time. Boys. She's running around calling boys all the time. Hey boys, come over here. Boys. That's what she calls them.
She probably did that in real life all the time. Who knows, you know?
I think so, yeah. I think there's a lot of you know, real bullpen shenanigans in this comic. And then sometimes when I got to the end of this, I thought, I wonder if Kirby didn't like Brodsky, because, you know, he kind of makes the Human Torch in this kind of being like a knucklehead. So I thought, oh, maybe that's just his way of, you know, maybe Brodsky was like a big jokester or something, but he seems like a bit of a goon in this. And I'm like, maybe Kirby didn't really like him.
Yeah, I think that could be it. You know, Brodsky's definitely, in this comic at least, you know, he's the one who gets the, you know, he doesn't get a lot of panels to himself. He doesn't do much other than melt a mother box like contraption later on. But basically, now we get into the story. Why are they in this cave system battling this caveman guy? And it seems that they were looking for a certain doctor. Mm-hmm. And his name is Dr. Murrow. And, mm-hmm. Billy, they're on an island. So think about it. The island of Dr. Murrow. It's like the island of Dr. Murrow from H.G. Wells. Whereas, you know, that Dr. Murrow from Wells's book was into mm-hmm. animal hybrid humans that he created. This Dr. Murrow seems to be a scientist who experiments mm-hmm. in other fields, but he has been transformed into a monster by cosmic rays, much like the Fantastic Four had been transformed into their superhero selves by cosmic rays. Now, before we get into why exactly that happens, we see this magnificent splash page, right, Billy? This one single giant image of them searching Dr. Murrow's lab after he's been taken out. And that is vintage mm-hmm. Kirby, wouldn't you agree?
Oh my gosh, yeah, like this giant, you know, room full of just Kirby tech everywhere. And then you have Stan, a.k.a. Mr. Fantastic, stretching his head like 20 feet above his body.
Yeah,
and
because
they're all looking around.
Yeah, they're searching for a box. Now, we know Kirby's obsessed with boxes, mother boxes. And they're searching for a box, and we start to realize that they know what could have caused the transformation in Dr. Murrow. Mm-hmm. It's a box that, similar to the one that apparently transformed them into their superior selves in the past. And then they're looking through this Kirby sci-fi tech, and again, Flo, she finds the box. Mm-hmm. Then it makes this box, like we mentioned off mic, it looks very similar to a mother box. And, you know, this is right after Kirby came back from DC. He probably had some, you know, concepts he still loved that was running around in his mind. And this box, she picks mm-hmm. it up, and it makes this weird little sound, right, Billy? Squeep, 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 when she finds it. And then, you know, Stan says, come on, we've no time to lose. Get out of there. And he grabs Flo, pulls her to safety, because right at that moment, this box starts emitting these cosmic rays.
Yeah, like it's booby-trapped or something.
Mm, exactly. So it already emitted cosmic rays, presumably, that transformed Professor Murrow. And then Saul melts it into a pile of slag and, you know, mm-hmm. shuts down the cosmic rays that way. And then, you know, they're saying, okay, now they got to find out who keeps sending these boxes to people mm-hmm. all around the world, because it happened to them. And then mm-hmm. cue the flashback. The Watcher... He mm-hmm. intercedes here in the story and then starts to explain exactly what happened related to these boxes. Now, Billy, you want to speak mm-hmm. on this. How did the Marvel bullpen become the Fantastic Four?
Yeah, it shows, you know, the bullpen at work at the office. You know, Lee and Kirby and Brodsky and Flo, they're all doing their jobs. And then, you know, hey, something came in the mail. It's a package. So they're obviously, you know, like, somebody sent us something. And, you know, of course, like, you know, you and I have talked about, it's, you know, they got fan mail and all sorts of stuff sent to them. So it wasn't, you know, something of the odd for to get a package, you know, from even fans, you know what I mean? So it was a box, and Flo has it, and they're like, I think we better unwrap this. And then, you know, they unwrap it, and it says, Flo says, you know, this is phrased so strangely. It reads like a slip you'd find in a fortune cookie. Exactly. And one of the boys says, okay, we've got Fu Manchu on the note. Now, what's in the box? And she says, well, this. And she gets the box out, and then it goes nuts.
Yeah, that's when the cosmic rays envelop them, and they are changed. And, you know, I love the fact that when Stan says, come on, Miss Sunshine, what have you brought me this time? Swedish candy, a toy owl. So those are actually literally stuff they really received from fans from across, you know, the States and even across the world sometimes. Fans of Marvel Comics send them some weird stuff. So Kirby put this in, you know, this is what he remembers from his time at Marvel. And then, you know, obviously they changed into these creatures, but not before Kirby shuts down the mother box with his shoe, just gives it a good old whack. Kabam!
A loafer and smashes it. Yeah. I forgot to tell you, too, when the Watcher is monologuing about this, you know, how this all went down, he says, We must recapture that aforementioned day, which has spent above a busy thoroughfare called Madison Avenue back in the early 1960s. Jack Kirby had arrived at the Marvel offices with some penciled pages for the editor, a fellow named Stan Lee. And then there's a little asterisk, and it says, pre-beard and pre-mustache, Roy Thomas.
Pre-beard and pre-mustache, that's right. But apparently not pre-toupee.
I was going to say, not pre-wig, though, yeah.
Yeah, definitely not. So, You know, yeah, I love the fact that, you know, this is also similar to what Kirby would put in, or what he did put in, if you look at it, peer back into the past. He put this in, you know, in the Fantastic Four comics as well, when the Yancey Street gang used to play pranks on Ben Grimm and sent him these packages with like a boxing glove on a spring, socks him in the nose, stuff like that. So when they get the letters and the, you know, boxes, Kirby says, why are these Frankensteiners picking on us? I love it.
Great line.
I love it.
So, you know, after Kirby uses his shoe to smash it up, Flo was hiding under the desk, and Brodsky's in the corner with a chair out in front of him like a lion tamer, and he says, well, it didn't scare me. I just grabbed this chair in case the nuts who sent it to us came by to hassle us.
So that's Kirby, maybe, yeah, like you say. He's saying Brodsky's a bit of a coward sometimes. Who knows?
A wuss. Yeah. And then they start their changing, you know. Kirby gets all pissed off about something. And he starts changing into the thing. And then the invisible girl or invisible woman and so on and so forth.
And Sol burns up a couple of the original art there from Kirby.
Yeah.
Jeez. Millions into the toilet there. And then he flies. And then, of course, this time around, though, Jack doesn't remain the thing. He seems to be able to control the transformation whenever he wills it. But, you know, Stan, he catches Sol before he plummets to his death with this giant rubber hand. Some pretty good penciling here by Kirby, if you think about it. Billy, there's this eerie panel where Stan is sort of... getting his hand back to normal, and it looks like this giant python on the carpet there stretching, and it's gross looking, but it's pretty well penciled, of course, like it's Kirby. But and then they start, you know, to wonder, like, how did this happen? What are they going to do? And then they look at this note again, like they say, this fortune cookie card, and it says, greetings, open this box and live the ultimate fantasy from the S people. So the S people change them into these monsters in their minds. So now they're going to hunt down the S people. That's their main goal now. And they still do the Marvel comics by day, but somehow they managed to find time to also live a life as superheroes. And it seems that Stan not only got, you know, the powers to, you know, stretch, but he also manages to stretch his mind, which allows him to become a scientific genius. Which kind of begs the question. I mean, Reed was always a scientific genius, even before he became, you know, Mr. Fantastic. But it could be that his powers gave him the, you know, ability to stretch his mind, you know, to increase his intelligence. Or I like that idea, you know. They never really mentioned that. I mean, that's mentioned in comics like Planetary or something, where it's like a Fantastic Four homage. But it's never mentioned in Marvel, I think. But this is definitely mentioned in this What If comic, though, right, Billy? That's why Stan could come up with these crazy gadgets that Mr. Fantastic is able to. And then, you know, there's a couple of scenes of them dealing with how, you know, Marvel Comics survives with their bullpen off on adventures all the time. And they mention Marie Severin, Johnny Romita, that new kid Thomas. And
we'll have him around to take up the slack.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. So those people, poor people, are being worked overtime. It's like a sweatshop, because our fabulous foursome are off, you know, jaunting around the universe in Stan's contraptions, looking for the S people. And they come back from a recent fruitless adventure where they didn't find any clue to the S people. And then Jack's just about to total Stan's machines. But Flo calms him down And then we see he can transform back into his human self. And then Flo says, "Why, Jack, don't stop now. I've never seen you look handsomer." "Oh, really? It's nice of you to say that, Flo. I'm not going to leave Ross for you, but thank you for saying that."
Yes, he's changing back to at their behest. He says, okay, don't treat me like a baby.
Yeah, because Stan's got him wrapped up in these folds, right, of his flesh. So then they decide, okay, they're getting closer to these devices that the S people leave lying around the Earth. Yeah. So they head off into Stan's high-tech submarine towards Atlantis. And then we've got Jack and Roy leaving an editor's note saying that on this alternate version of our Earth, the Submariner and other villains have real-life counterparts. So that explains why the Submariner's here. So, Billy, what happens?
Looks super cool, too. Oh, it looks so good. That Atlantis, Kirby's artwork, man.
Ooh, it looks completely different than the Atlantis we're used to. You know, like as conceived by Bill Everett and then later on by Gene Colan and so forth. But, you know, I like Kirby's Atlantis even more. It's high-tech. It's weird. It looks vaguely ocean-like. You know, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, Billy, speak on this. When they get there, immediately they're being bombarded by rays from the Submariner and his Atlantean soldiers.
Their weapons. It's they sonic subdue blast. Them. It's funny.
Yeah,
it's funny. He goes, and then after they blast them, Subby says, "Send a pickup team to bring in that motley crew. They should be meek as goldfish after that sonic blast."
And they are. Oh yeah, they are. I mean, he even manages to strap them in this device upside down, and they're he's over there interrogating them, and then he has already found the box that they're looking for, and he's blaming the Fantastic Four for hiding it in Atlantis. He thinks it's a bomb. They wanted to blow it up. And then when Stan sees the box that they've tracked to Atlantis that Subby now holds in his hand, Stan immediately says, "Holy Hannah, he's got one too. Get rid of it. Destroy it." And then he does destroy it, but that panel's great. Subby crushes it into little pieces, and then he looks at Stan and says, "A sound idea, ignoble one, considering the evil it generates. This is your creation, isn't it, smiling Stan Lee?" So what does that mean? Does Submariner read the comics that they're putting out?
He probably belongs to the MMMS, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Mighty Marvel Marching Society. Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
Kirby goes nuts Kirby goes nutty and makes the whole thing table that they're on break into pieces. And then they're going to fight. And I love it how Subby's like, "I'll take on all four of them." And Stan's like, "Come on, no, let's not do this, blah, 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 blah." And Kirby, "Make your play, fish face."
Oh, and then, I don't know what he does, but Stan inflates his body to block, the punch, because he's still trying to smooth matters over here, that Nabor's leveling at the thing. And then Jack is giving Stan some pointers in brawling here. He says, "That's the wrong way to block a punch, Stan. Let me show you the real mayhem at its best." And then they're throwing around some insults and smack talk, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they eventually come to peaceful terms here, though, after a little bit of a fracas. Yeah,
thanks to Flo. I mean, after everybody shows off their powers a bit, Saul, puts a wall of flame between the Jack and Submariner. And, eventually they calm down. But Flo sort of... she became invisible, then she became visible again, and she sort of started caressing the Submariner's face and calming him down with her words. She said, "Oh, you don't fool me, you big, handsome teddy bear. I know that your savage temper is a cover-up for a heart that's warm and just." That's probably how Kirby remembers Flo smoothing over some tense situations in the bullpen. I'm positive that must be it, right? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And then, Submariner's convinced of the Fantastic Four's innocence. And then, he commits to helping them track down whoever the S people are. Because after all, they've threatened Atlantis now. So he points to one of his servants or soldiers, and he says, "Uncover the extraterrestrial monitor." So now they're thinking that, you know, it might be an invasion from space. These S people might be aliens experimenting on Earth people. And Submarine has the devices to detect these aliens. So this alien detector that he has, he activates it, and it makes another funny sound. Ree! Click! By Poseidon's beard, we've not only found our quarry, but he's here in this very chamber. So the aliens are already among us, right? So, Billy, what happens next? The S people. Who are they?
One of the guards, you know, kind of jumps out of nowhere, and he's like, uh-oh, they know from that it's one of the S people, and he has, like, a spear, but he's got, like, a little device inside it that, like, kind of shoots off the end of the spear, and there's, like, a momentary vacuum, it says, by thinning the oxygen in the surrounding air, and it kind of knocks all five of them out. Well, actually, everybody in the room, I'm sorry. I thought it was just the five of them. But no, it knocks out everybody in the entire room, and then this person changes his face and says, "You should have guessed that the S people are Skrulls."
Yeah, dude, that's a great four-panel page. But, you know, this reminds me of a lot of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was remade around this time, right? I was kind of expecting Donald Sutherland to show up or something, because the reveal when they know that there's aliens among us, you know, is very Invasion of the Body Snatchers-esque. So the Skrulls, the S people, one of the Fantastic Four's very first foes, the race of Skrulls that can shape change, and they're here. They're experimenting on humans. They want to change humans into these, well, monstrosities to serve them, right? That's basically the whole reason they're doing it. And then everybody's unconscious. The Skrull, you know, he's already ready to get some new boxes going. And then he tries to sort of, you know, well, he walks around the base. And his plan is just to basically, you know, just escape. But also to, you know, like I say, enact this plan of enslaving the Earth. But then he becomes a whale, right, Billy? At one point in time, it's great. He says he's gonna leave. Farewell, fool! He thinks to the Atlantean guard that he passes. But then, you know,
it's one of my favorite, like, bizarre panels ever. Like, sometimes when you do, like, a Google search on, like, weird comic book panels and stuff like that, that panel comes up. You just see a guard standing there, and it says, "The Skrull leaves unnoticed in a form common to dwellers of the deep." And a thought bubble from this fish. Farewell, fool.
Oh, it's great. It's amazing. Oh, yeah, so he's trying to escape, so he swims towards his hidden spaceship, you know, parked on the ocean floor near Atlantis, and then, you know, Fantastic Four and Submariner recover, they vow revenge, and they take off in one of Namor's undersea craft, and they track down the Skrull. So they got to stop him from leaving, because after all, they got to find out where the rest of these boxes are. It seems that it's a one-man job, the Skrull, right? He's probably like, he's not the Super Skrull, but he's probably a super secret agent for the Skrulls. He's like the Skrull James Bond. Because they sent one man, one Skrull, I mean, to do all of this across the Earth. But then, you know, they manage to catch up with his spaceship. And then the Thing and Namor go into action. Now, Billy, this is a fantastic page. And it's got one particular panel that's just eye-poppingly amazing. They rip this ship apart in tandem. And it's like, zvoom! And you've got this fantastic explosion, this Kirby explosion.
That's great.
Now, it seemed that the entire ship, the escape ship, it was populated with more Skrulls, right? Because this agent and the rest of his crew of the ship that was waiting for him, they perish in this.
Oh, my gosh.
Brutal.
It's nasty. And then the caption box, or boxes, "It is the end for the aliens caught in the catastrophe. Suddenly, the deeps are rocked by a powerful tremor, which brings to the surface the satanic products of an evil dream."
Oh, that's great writing. Who said satanic. Kirby can't write? Come on, the satanic products of an evil dream? Kirby,
that's great.
He's a great writer, I think. You know, I love Kirby's writing, too. not just the art. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's a massive undersea explosion.
Yep.
And then they've managed to thwart the plans of these Skrulls. And Stan says, do you hear that? It means we've deep-sixed the entire Skrull operation. Yeah, and mm-hmm. then, yeah, they're heroes. They've saved the world from these cosmic rays. And it turns out that the Skrulls were the master of the cosmic ray in this story, right, Billy?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Watcher ends the tale by saying, thus, on this earth, undaunted spirits remain strong and able to pursue a monumental task. And he says, humanity in any dimension is forever concerned with its true identity. It clings to it with tenacity and would sacrifice all to retain it. I've seen this happen in endless succession, for I am the Universal I. Almost like Kirby's OMAC, Brother I, right? And then he just ends by saying, I am the Watcher.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then caption box here with a huge faux pas.
Yeah, that next didn't issue. Happen.
At last, Conan. Nah, wrong.
Yeah, what if Conan walked the Earth today? Nope, my comic's going to be next. Not that that Conan issue isn't amazing in its own right. I think that was issue 13, mm-hmm. right, Billy? But maybe some art duties were incomplete on that. I don't know the story behind why they made this error, but, mm-hmm. you know, obviously the next issue is the one we're going to be discussing, and it's not about Conan at all. But this mm-hmm. one, this is definitely a fantastic issue. I mean, pardon the pun, Fantastic Four. This is a really fantastic issue. Yeah. I loved it. And the Kirby art, like
it's
say,
a blast.
Every panel's just marvelous. So, mm-hmm. Billy, you picked a good one, man.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
Thank you.
Yeah. I have to give it to you here. And then let's off, hightail it onto the next one here. But I got a little mm-hmm. bit of a reason behind why I picked this issue. This was my mm-hmm. first What If, issue number 12. What mm-hmm. If, and I'm going to give the premise just now, but I picked this one up. I in fact, didn't pick it up off the stands. It was in a Hulk annual, which you didn't get in the States. It was printed by a British company, and they had some kind of a license to print, you know, Hulk annuals at the end of the year, and they would distribute them just in time for Christmas. And it was these little hardcover annuals you only got in Britain. And they were printed by this company called, I think, Marvel Grand Dreams or something. And, you know, so we got a lot of British comics, of course, in South Africa, too. And there were a couple of stories in that Hulk annual. Well, one of them was The Day the Earth Turned Green, you know, that famous Hulk story. And I think it was mm-hmm. these were all from 1982 or something, but they also reprinted mm-hmm. older issues, you know, from the late 70s in these annuals that they released. And one of them was this number 12 from What If, and it, of course, like I already gave away, it concerns the Hulk. But before we get to the mm-hmm. premise, which is basically just the one cent, the question that they asked, the what mm-hmm. if question, I got mm-hmm. a bit of details about this comic for us. This is, of course, like I mentioned, issue 12 of What If Volume 1, cover date of mm-hmm. December 1978, on sale September 26th, 1978. Cover by Sal Buscema, inked by Joe Sinnott. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about a great Kirby inker earlier. There you go with Joe. Mm-hmm. And then edited by Roy Thomas. And writer on this one is Don Glut. Now, Billy, mm-hmm. you and I are Don Glut fans because he's also a horror fan. You know, Don Glut. He sometimes writes horror. So we've talked about him in the past. And, of course, mm-hmm. Hulk penciler supreme, my favorite Hulk artist of all time, Sal Buscema on this one. Inked by Bill Black, mm-hmm. lettered by Bruce Patterson, and colored by George Roussos. And, of mm-hmm. course, you can find this reprinted in the new, you know, Omnibus, What If Omnibus, and your issue, too, that we discussed. And in the paperback collections, Volume 1, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Billy, the premise here, again, is the synopsis. What if Rick Jones had become the Hulk? Now, if you're a fan of the Avengers and the Captain Marvel comics over at Marvel, featuring Mar-Vell, the Kree warrior that came to Earth, you would enjoy this issue much more because you would know mm-hmm. what they're referencing all the time. After all, Rick was not only associated with the Hulk, he also briefly became an Avenger. you know, or he joined the Avengers as a, in a kind of snapper car role, if you want to use a DC yeah. analogy there. And he also mm-hmm. became linked to Captain Marvel because they wanted to create this Billy Batson, Shazam, you know, original Captain Marvel dynamic between him and Mar-Vell. And they had these nega bands. And when Rick slammed them together, he would call Marvel out of the negative zone. And he would be mm-hmm. replaced and he would go into the negative zone. And then mm-hmm. Marvel could do his super heroics. And then he would slam the bands together again and return to the negative zone. And Rick could continue his life. So that kind of Billy Batson, you know, Shazam dynamic. Right. And this is all in there, right, Billy? And there's Kree Skrull yeah. War stuff in here. Basically, it's what if, you know, Rick Jones was Rick Jones, but also a teenaged Hulk. So I don't know, what did you think about this issue? Because I, you know, kind of forced it on you just because it's my first issue of What If. And nostalgically, I guess it's also my favorite.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is a lot of fun. Yeah. This is a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Billy, because otherwise mm-hmm. I would have felt bad. I enjoyed your issue immensely. Of course, I would have mm-hmm. loved if you enjoyed this one. So good on you. Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting one. It doesn't really have one linear story. It's sort of like highlights from Rick Jones's life in the early Bronze Age or in the early Silver Age to his Bronze Age appearances. And it seems that Rick, you know, he has had a very eventful life in Marvel, even without this What If issue. He's right. been involved in everything from the Hulk to like we say, the Avengers, the Kree-Skrull War, Captain Marvel, and later on, of course, as well in many other things too. You know, he became A-Bomb at one point in time in the modern comics. He became a Gamma villain or a Gamma hero, and so it starts off with just a great cover. By Sal Buscema, and it has Rick transforming into the Hulk with the military in the background, General Ross standing over there, and Bruce Banner providing some exposition. Good Lord, that boy's turning into some kind of huge green-skinned monster, and it's all my fault.
And there we have Thunderbolt Ross lurking in the background as well.
That's right, yep, he's there. And basically, it opens with the famous scene where Bruce Banner, and this is very conceivable that Rick could have become the Hulk, because after all, Bruce Banner was out there at the test site where they're going to detonate the gamma bomb, trying to get Rick out of there, because he was mm-hmm. there just, what, chilling, playing some music, he's on a harmonica, mm-hmm. and then, you know, Bruce dragged him to the ditch, and as we know, he threw Rick into the ditch to get him to safety, and then the gamma bomb exploded, turning Bruce Banner into the Hulk. But the Watcher presents us with a different scenario. What if Rick was more of a rebel than he usually is, and he didn't believe that Bruce, you know, had his best interests at heart by dragging him out of his car, and mm-hmm. he, with some kind of a judo move, threw Bruce Banner into the ditch mm-hmm. first.
Yep.
And that's a great scene, you know. Bruce is there at the ditch, and then Rick grabs him and hurls him, and then he says, "You go in the ditch, in the trench first, mister." I should call it a trench. "But there's no time." "Then we'll have to make some." Nope. "Sorry, Rick. You can't argue with the bomb, because the mm-hmm. gamma bomb explodes and irradiates him." So Billy, now mm-hmm. speak on the next. Now we cut to the Watcher then coming in and saying, "Oh, this is going to be tragic for poor old Rick." And then we cut to the hospital, well, the doctor's office on the presumably the military base where Bruce is working, and the doctor gives Rick the go-ahead. He's clear. He's got no ill effects from the bomb. But we learn that's not true when the sun sets, just like in the old Hulk comics, right? By Lee and Kirby. The sun sets, and what happens?
Yeah, Rick starts, like, trembling, and, you know, Banner's like, "What's going on? What's wrong?" And he's like, "Nothing." And he goes, "Don't tell me nothing's wrong. You're sick. I'll call the doc." And then he says, "Oh, my God." And then we see Rick. He starts, you know, changing, and he says, "Get off my back unless you want to rumble." And he turns into the Hulk.
Now, what's great about this Hulk is he keeps Rick's slang, but he also does mm-hmm. slang in Hulk speak. So mm-hmm. it's stuff like, "Bah, square, too chicken to fight." "Hulk don't need square's help. You know, Hulk just need to be free. Soldiers, uncool." You know, he's like, this is great. This is great.
So
they spot him breaking out of this building, General Ross and two of the military police on the base. And then Hulk doesn't fight them. He leaps away. And they mention in the editor's notes that Hulk would only discover his leaping ability much later in the regular 616 universe. But here, driven by Rick's youthful enthusiasm and daring spirit, he leaps straight off the get-go here. So he leaps to safety. General Ross is already incensed. We know how much he hates monsters. He's sending everybody out to look for the Hulk. And that's where he gets his name, because one of the soldiers, the MPs, say, "What is that? That Hulk?" You know, kind of like what happened in the original comics, right, Billy? And he says, "It's like he's a monster, but he's got a kid's face, like something out of I Was a Teenage Frankenstein."
Good movie.
Yeah, great movie, man. And then Hulk says, "So, I'm called Hulk, huh?" Hulk won't rumble with soldiers. Hulk will cut out instead.
Yeah, that's, like you said, that's a trip. He's calling everybody, he doesn't like squares. He keeps referring to Banner as Four Eyes.
Yeah.
Throughout the issue. That's great.
Oh, man, it's great. And then, you know, he leaps away, but Bruce tracks him down. And then just in time for the sunrise, where, you know, he changes back to Rick. And Rick realizes he's got a problem. And Professor Banner's going to help him because he feels responsible. He feels he's to blame for Rick's transformation. So he's going to do some tests, find a cure for him. But they have to protect him from himself first of all. And he takes him into this underground bunker. And he basically imprisons Rick, but, you know, Rick goes willingly. So when night falls, Rick changes into Hulk again. And it seems that this underground bomb shelter where Bruce imprisons him is Hulk-proof because he can't escape.
Yeah.
No. At night, he tries to break his way out of there, but unsuccessfully. And Bruce works on a machine that can revert him back to normal. But while all this is happening, you know, during the day, Bruce lets him out and Rick can, you know, do what he wants. He can, you know, practice his guitar because he's a budding musician. But then, you know, we get into normal Marvel 616 continuity. Billy, who arrives from the realm of the gods?
That would be Loki.
Loki, in his wraith-like form here, leaves Asgard and he tries, of course, to make things hell for his brother Thor again. And he finds the perfect weapon against the Thunder God. He finds Rick Jones. You know, now this also ties in with how the Avengers formed, right, Billy? I mean, we know that Loki was the reason the Avengers formed in the comics, why they came together to combat Loki. But also we know that Rick, in normal Marvel 616 continuity, he started a group called the Teen Brigade. Right, and they had you know, these radios that they were sporting around with them, monitoring government, you know, broadcasts and frequencies and police bands and whatnot. And they're the ones who picked up the transmission, you know, that alerted the rest of the Avengers to the threat of the Hulk, which was actually Loki, you know, causing the Hulk to appear as a threat, and that brought the Avengers together to fight the Hulk, and then they joined up against Loki eventually. So now this is again kind of, it's a convoluted way of getting there, but it does, because now instead of immediately using the Hulk as, you know, a weapon, he first sort of needs to cause Rick's transformation to happen whenever he wants to. So he uses his Asgardian magic to just, while Rick is free and walking around in his, as a normal human, Loki sort of forces the change during daylight. And so Bruce Banner's ready for this, though, because luckily the machine has been perfected. So he blasts the Hulk with this gamma machine to cure him. Yeah. And it works because he reverts back to Rick. But then Loki just says, we're not having that. And he just uses his magic to overpower earthly science and crablong. Hulk Rick punches this machine of Bruce and he totals it and leaps away. So now it seems that the Hulk can affect, because of Loki's magic in this What If story, he can affect the transformation anytime he wants to, right, Billy?
Yeah, absolutely.
And now it goes into the more, you know, familiar story of Loki tricking the Hulk into committing these, causing a series of disasters, like, you know, smashing a train track. But that's because Loki placed the illusion of a wad of dynamite there, and Hulk was trying to save the track and then ends up destroying it.
Right.
And then the Avengers form to combat the Hulk. Eventually they defeat Loki, and then the Hulk joins the Avengers as Rick Jones, the Hulk.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Bruce Banner's still working on the machine trying to cure Rick. And eventually the Hulk, the Space Phantom pretends to be Iron Man. And then, you know, they fight Iron Man, and the Hulk doesn't like that. Even though he knows this is not the real Iron Man, at the end, he's like saying, "Bah, Avengers turned on Hulk. First, bad guys are bad, and then good guys are good, and now bad guys are good, and good guys are bad." You know, Hulk's had enough of this. Mm-hmm. So he says, "Why should Hulk hang out with you lowlives?" From now on, Hulk does solo gig. And then Bruce comes out with his machine and just blasts him in the back and seemingly cures him. So the rest of the Avengers, Giant Man and Iron Man, they're flabbergasted. They can't believe that, geez, the Hulk is just a kid. And so that seems to be it, right, Billy? Because Bruce has cured Rick, and Rick says, "Thanks for giving me a new lease on life, Doc." And Rick heads off, ready to start his life anew. But that doesn't happen, Billy, because who does Rick meet in an alleyway soon after being cured?
Yeah, he comes around the corner, and there's Captain America kicking the crap out of a bunch of, looks like Hydra agents.
Yeah, Hydra goons.
And one of them's about to shoot Cap in the back, so Rick comes flying in and grabs a guy and punches him, and they're like, "Hey, thanks for saving my life." And then he starts training Rick to be his sidekick.
To be the new Bucky. Now, this also happened in continuity, right, Billy? But, of course, here it's going to be slightly different because, yes, you've got Rick learning the fighting skills from Cap, the necessary skills to be an Avenger. And he does go on multiple adventures with Cap. But in the heat of battle, again, against Hydra, you know, the stress causes the change. So he's not been cured. It was just a temporary cure. And while they're fighting these Hydra goons in a Hydra base, and there's some great Sal Buscema action panels here, right, Billy? There's one where where Rick clocks a guy and then his tooth goes flying out of his mouth. Rick starts to feel the strain, the stress, and he turns into the Hulk. And with one, well, with a double hand, well, it's kind of a double punch, right? He smashes all the Hydra goons, and Cap is, you know, he cannot, you know, he doesn't find the words to express his surprise here. He says, "What, Rick? Oh my good lord, Rick's the Hulk!" And the Hulk is like saying, "Hulk gets to bust some heads," and he's about to kill these guys when Cap appeals to his better nature, and then Hulk says, "Cap, right? Hulk may be tough guy, but Hulk ain't no bully." And then he leaves, and then Cap is left without a partner, and Cap's very sad about it. You can see that.
Yeah.
So again, there's no real story here, Billy. This is just scenes from Rick Jones's life. What if he was the Hulk? And then you know, where we had the S people in the Fantastic Four issue sort of driving the narrative, here we've just got Rick, you know, going through the motions. And Rick, again, he realizes he hasn't been cured, so he has to find a way to live with the Hulk now. But he ends up seeing an image of Captain America, you know, luring him away. And it happened in Captain Marvel number 17, where he was sort of drawn to Mar-Vell. And he acquired the Negabands, which he calls these far-out bracelets. And, you know, he hears the psychic voice of Captain Marvel in his head and says, you know, "Slam the bands together." And fantastic, ka-tang, Rick is instantly transported into the negative zone with Captain Marvel obviously taking his place on Earth. But then, Billy, who shows up? Who is in the negative zone? And who rules the negative zone at this point in time?
Yeah, like we didn't mention it earlier, but, you know, when he trades places with Mar-Vell, sometimes there's, you know, shenanigans in the negative zone because Rick's just a guy. So, you know.
Yeah.
situations like this occur where he changes, he switches places with Captain Marvel, and he turns around and there's a Nihilus.
That's right. The Death, who, you know, obviously rules, as he say, mm-hmm. the living Death, as he calls himself, who rules the mm-hmm. Negative Zone at this point in time. And, you know, he's intent on killing Rick because he sees Rick as an invader, but he also realizes he's tied to the hated Marvel. Who he's kind of met before, and who Marvel has staved him off with his power in the Negative Zone. So Captain Marvel's safe when he's in the Negative Zone. Luckily, the Supreme Intelligence of the Kree is on hand to help Rick, because after all, the Kree Supreme Intelligence has, you know, an investment in Captain Marvel. He wouldn't like to see him, you know, die. So he needs to protect Rick. And then they sort of give Rick this power. Well, they unlock the latent psychic powers, the you know, in the human race, but also use the Kree's, you know, in the powers that they can sort of channel through Rick. So Rick manages to repel Annihilus, but this will not always work. You know, because the Kree Supreme Intelligence will not be you know, available after this Kree-Skrull War. This is just because they needed them during the Kree-Skrull War. And as we know, Billy, didn't Rick single-handedly end the Kree-Skrull War in normal continuity? You know, he manifested some Golden Age heroes and saved the day. So Rick Jones is a very important player in Marvel. And then, you know, we have scenes of that, but Rick ends up dying because his life force has been spent, you know, fighting the Kree-Skrull War, but Captain Marvel then willingly bonds with him again in order to save his life, to sort of
keep him alive.
They merge their life forces, and Rick's not happy with that. He would have rather have died. He doesn't want the Jekyll and Hyde act again, but he has no choice. So, and that's where the Captain Marvel comic starts again, right, Billy, in the 70s. Rick and Captain Marvel being this duo, and I liked it. Did you read it back in the day?
A little bit here and there, not a lot. Just some here and there, like some of the Starlin stuff.
Of course, the Starlin stuff's the best, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually, of course, Captain Marvel would be exposed to the gas by Nitro that would give him cancer. And then, but by then, Rick was free of him, because all they had to do is to free Rick from his, you know, and Captain Marvel's merger, is to open a portal to the Negative Zone and somehow take Rick out of the negative zone without him slamming the bands together, and then he will be free of Captain Marvel. They will both be free.
Yeah.
And who is a Negative Zone expert? And of course, Bruce Banner, he realizes you know, that Rick still needs help, and he wants to save Rick because he still feels responsible for him. So, Billy, speak on that. Who do they draft to help them out?
Yeah, not Stan Lee. It is Reed Richards.
Damn, I almost wish it was Smiling Stan.
Yeah, they're going to try to figure out how to help Rick out here. It's great.
That's right. So, but while Rick is now still trapped in the Negative Zone, Captain Marvel has been knocked out by some form of gas. The gas that he was exposed to, Compound 13, that we mentioned earlier, from Captain Marvel number 34. And then he can't slam the bands together on Earth to bring Rick back so that he could stave off Annihilus. And now Rick's at the mercy of Annihilus, and he's going to be killed. And in fact, Annihilus grabs him and starts to strangle him. And Captain Marvel can't wake up. So now it's a race against time. What am I saying here? I was going to call Mr. Fantastic Captain Fantastic. That's a what if for another day, right? So Mr. Fantastic and Bruce Banner and Rick's girlfriend, who he's met during this time, they sort of whip up the machine that's gonna cure Rick again. But well, this time Bruce has been working on a different machine. It's a gamma machine that will separate Rick from the Hulk, and Mr. Fantastic's working on his Negative Zone portal, which will allow him to access the Negative Zone and pull Rick out of there.
Yeah.
Which did happen in regular continuity as well. So this Gammatron that Bruce calls it is going to do that. But they need to open the portal and blast Rick with this machine. And then they're going to leave the Hulk trapped in the Negative Zone and pull out the real Rick. That's their plan.
Rick, yeah.
But to do that, they have to sort of save Rick from Annihilus first. And Rick retains some of the training of Captain America here. He punches Annihilus in the face, right? Billy Plud. But of course, his training is nothing against Annihilus, who's capable of taking on the Thing mano a mano. Yeah. So he just smacks Rick in the face and then, you know, starts strangling him again. But the strain is too much. Now, this is fantastic, Billy. I don't know what you're about, but as a kid, when I read this comic over and over again, I love this battle. What happens here? We've got three panels of Annihilus realizing his mistake here in causing Rick to stress out. What happens?
Yeah, he's choking away and having a monologue, and then he's like, wait a minute, why is your skin changing hue? And then the next page, it's a huge splash page of the Hulk just kicking the crap out of Annihilus, like, smashes him and flies, and, like, his little demon friends are there watching.
Yeah, his subjects, his slaves, really, Annihilus' slaves. This is the money shot, Billy. This splash panel by Sal Buscema is incredible. Ooh. It's a Sal Buscema punch, vrop, and just the Hulk absolutely bashing the brains, almost the brains out of Annihilus here. Annihilus goes flying. You know, he's dizzy. Hulk's about to finish him off when suddenly, for some reason, he appears back on Earth. You know, and it's the 3 hours, the allotted 3 hours that, you know, Captain Marvel is allowed to remain on Earth that has expired. So the Negabends automatically transported Captain Marvel back into the negative zone. But of course, he's still unconscious from the gas. So now Annihilus can wreak his vengeance on an unconscious Captain Marvel. But Hulk is very upset about this. He says, "What a bummer. Hulk back home and wearing bracelets like some chick. But where's Bugman?" So Hulk's not happy with this. He's ready to rumble. So he slams the bands together trying to get them off because he said, "Hulk ain't no sissy. Won't wear bracelets." And what happens, Billy, when he slams the bands together?
He's in the, like, go ahead.
No. I just wanted to say, we know, you need to be, the one on Earth needs to be the one that slams the bands together to call the person back out from the negative zone, right?
Yep, that's the only way it works.
Yeah, and so when the Hulk tries to smash off the bracelets, you know, and Annihilus is just about to rip out Captain Marvel, the unconscious Captain Marvel's throat, Hulk reappears and immediately, well, there's a great bit of dialogue there, right, Billy? You want to read that for us?
Yeah, so right at the part where you're saying about him smashing the bracelets together, I did see one time, too, I think it was, maybe it was the page before, where the bracelets kind of disappeared, and I was like, what's going on there? But I guess we can just blame Sal for that one there.
Yeah, the bracelets are not supposed to disappear, when you're in the negative zone. You're still supposed to have them, but when he transformed into the Hulk, Sal forgot to draw the bracelets on the Hulk.
Yeah, I thought for a minute, I thought maybe I missed something, so I went back and read the dialogue, and I'm thinking, no, I think he just missed it.
Yeah. He should have drawn the bracelets on the Hulk. I mean, you could have had the Hulk not noticing the bracelets in the heat of battle. That would have been fine. But when he reappeared on Earth after, you know, the 3 hours expired and then wore the bracelets, that's weird. That's not the way it was supposed to work. And then Captain Marvel doesn't have the bracelets on when he reappears in the negative zone. So, yeah, some faux pas there. And then again, the Hulk doesn't have the bracelets when he reappears in the negative zone after he smashes. So yeah, some mistakes there.
Yeah, and then Annihilus has like a pistol and he starts zapping the crap out of him with that too.
Yeah, because you know, after all, he's privy to technology that could hurt the Thing, and you know that's happened in the past. So now he uses that on the Hulk. But before he does that, the portal to the negative zone has been opened by Mr. Fantastic, and they've targeted the Hulk, and Bruce activates the Gamatron, and it blasts the Hulk while he's in the heat of battle, and it works. It separates Rick Jones from the Hulk, and now they're two separate figures floating free of each other. The Hulk's just ignoring Rick completely. He's going to take on Bugman!
Bugman, he calls Annihilus.
now after that happens, Hulk feels really weird when Rick left his body, right, when they were separated, but then no sooner that happened than Hulk says, "Hulk feels groovy again. So now Hulk will finish stomping Bugman." Now, this was a great scene for me. I don't know why I loved it so much, but Mr. Fantastic stretching into the negative zone, to reach, and he's stretching across vast distances here, right, Billy, in order
to
reach,
grab him.
Yeah, to grab Rick in this giant hand and pull him back through the negative zone. But Rick's floating away from him, so the strain is immense on Mr. Fantastic. But while all this is happening, Hulk and Bugman, Annihilus, they're fighting it out. And then Hulk gets the better of Annihilus because he says, "Huh, somehow Hulk has learned how to fancy kick." So this is Captain America's training, the martial arts training that's in Hulk's subconscious. And he says, "That's tough for Bugman." And tham, he gong fu kicks Annihilus. And then he punches him out. But he's not down and out, though, because then, like you say, he uses that life-draining blaster on the Hulk. So Hulk is losing then. He's on the losing end of the battle. But while that is happening, Mr. Fantastic manages to snag Rick like a toy, like an action figure. Mm-hmm. And he pulls him through the gate just before the portal closes, before they ran out of power. So Rick's safe. He's with his girlfriend, Luann. They start a kiss.
Oh, yeah.
And then Mr. Fantastic and Bruce Banner just leaves and smiles and ain't love grand. And then Mr. Fantastic drafts, you know, Bruce Banner to help him cure a friend called Ben Grimm. But while Rick and Luann are smooching away, we've still got the Hulk in dire straits here. He's dying in the negative zone from this blaster. And Annihilus is just enjoying the hell out of the situation, killing the Hulk. But then Hulk manages to get the upper hand. What does he do, Billy?
Well, he gets all like charged up because the little, as he calls them, little weirdos, which means the Annihilus' subjects. He goes, "They want Hulk to beat Bugman. They keep cheering for Hulk to win." So he grabs a piece of like debris, like an asteroid or something, and throws it at Annihilus and knocks the pistol out of his hand and then just beats the crud out of him.
Yeah, you know, because they're cheering for him. These little weirdos. That's you and me, Billy. We're sitting there on a rock podcasting, you know, live this battle. And then this is great. You know, right after he's hurled a fastball at Annihilus with this boulder that he chucked at him, Annihilus is sort of briefly unconscious and he drifts towards the Hulk, and Hulk winds up this massive punch. And he kills Annihilus. He takes him out with one punch, and then Annihilus flies into this rock and it just explodes.
Yeah, he's
because
dead.
It seemed that he hit the gun at the same time, and then you know, on impact with whatever obstacle he hit, it triggered it was called the Negato gun. It triggered the mechanism and the power cell. Yeah, and it just exploded because that was his ultimate weapon, right? So it's powerful enough to destroy him. And then Hulk says, "Bugman was wiped out, but Hulk couldn't care less. Bugman was just a punk."
That's great.
But he can't go back to his own stomping ground, so he's trapped in the negative zone forever. And then we just leave him with his thoughts, right? And then we have cut back to the regular Earth where now Captain Marvel's free, and Rick is free of Captain Marvel, and they're all having a bit of a reunion with Bruce Banner. And Captain Marvel thanks Rick for, you know, all their time together and all the adventures they've shared. And he takes off. And then Rick Jones and, they look at him, Captain Marvel, flying off in the sky. But then we end on a bit of a happy splash page, Billy. So what is that final splash page there? Oh, it's great.
Oh, it's insane. It's Hulk out in space just, you know, or in the negative zone, I'm sorry, smashing rocks to bits with the little weirdos all watching him and like cheering him on. And
Jarella, how the heck?
I don't know why she's there. And the Watcher doing his, you know, normal like closing monologue,
where he says, "Here, where but here can the Hulk know respect and admiration, and yes, perhaps even love, as the mighty and noble champion who liberated one and all from the tyranny of Annihilus. I should know of such a place, for I am the Watcher." So you know what I'm thinking, Billy? I'm thinking the Watcher cut Hulk a little bit of slack here. He interfered again, as he's known to do, and he got Jarella from her micro-dimension, and he transplanted her into the negative zone to be with Hulk and fall in love with Hulk. And, you know, Hulk's happy just bouncing around on these boulders in the negative zone. With this crowd of admirers, these little weirdos. So Hulk is the ruler of the negative zone at the end of this comic. Amazing. As Rick would say, fantastic. So that's it for our two what if issues. Now, Billy, final verdict. What did you think of this Hulk issue?
Oh, I thought it was great. It's really awesome. And I do like how it kind of tricked me, you know, thinking it was going to be just, you know, the Hulk scenarios and him changing back into Rick. But instead it was Rick's life, you know, just with the Hulk in the background or two. That threw me for a loop. I was not expecting that. And it was really cool. But I should have expected that from Don Glut because he does some wild stuff.
Yeah, he's a great writer. He's an amazing guy. And he did take us for quite a ride here, you know, because, it was Rick Jones's life. It didn't really focus on the Beats and the Hulk at all. A great decision by Glut there because it worked. And I'm glad the Hulk became happy at the end. Teenage Rick Jones Hulk, you know, in the negative zone, which is like his heaven, free from, you know, the soldiers, the discrimination, the punks, the weirdos. Well, the weirdos are still there, but they're the cool weirdos.
and before I forget, I would be remiss if I did not mention, you know, you and I tossed this cover back and forth to each other and laughed too, is I don't know who made it, but that crazy parody cover, what if Rick James had become the Hulk?
Yes. Oh, that is great. Oh, that is amazing. That cover's been floating around. I first saw it on Pinterest somewhere. Well, I'll post that on our blog over at sinkintotheweird.com for you viewers. I think many people already have seen it, right, Billy? But that's a great cover. Oh, Rick James.
And then, Bruce Banner's dialogue says, good Lord, that brother's turning into some kind of green skin monster. And it's super freaky.
And it's super fly. It's super freaky. Oh, that's a great cover. Good. Yeah, it's amazing. Oh, what could have been, right? What if, you know, Marvel had really, you know, gotten Rick James along with Kiss and Alice Cooper to do a what if issue? That would have been amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
So, Billy, let's hit straight on into our Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel missteps. We're not going to insert a break here because we're on a roll. What are some of your Bronze Age Brilliance moments and Mighty Marvel missteps for both issues?
So, Bronze Age Brilliance, definitely in the Hulk issue, it definitely, without a doubt, was the dialogue. Oh my gosh, like we said, Rick saying, you know, calling people squares and four eyes, and at one point he calls himself a Lowrider Jones. I was loving that. And like you said too, it's even twice as funny when it's coming out of the Hulk's mouth instead of Rick Jones. It makes it even twice as funny.
Precisely, yeah. That's also my Bronze Age Brilliance for the Hulk issue. My Bronze Age Brilliance for the Fantastic Four issue is the Kirby memories that he injected into the story. You know, his time in the office with Stan and his remembrances of Saul and Flo and, just the way that he married the whole Marvel bullpen mythology that we've come to know through Stan's soapbox and through, you know, the letter columns. And how he put that into the Fantastic Four comic. And I think that's a fitting end for the last Jack Kirby Fantastic Four comic that he penciled. You know, to have the bullpen as the Fantastic Four. Because that's where the magic happened, right, Billy?
Yeah. For me, it's the same thing, too. Just like you said, the behind the scenes. Mm. Like when it's showing their origin in that book, you know. And it's showing them at the office and then getting the fan mail and stuff like that, and the in jokes. I love that. That's definitely my favorite part, you know, my brilliance for that issue as well.
Yeah, because it's sort of like a moment that's now lost to the annals of history, because moments, I should say, because Kirby would never have that again. Stan wouldn't have that again. He was off in California at that time dealing with the, you know, Marvel properties and TV and so forth. And of course, Flo had gone her separate ways. Saul was still, you know, chugging away, but they were not together anymore. So, yeah, it's bittersweet, and I loved it. And, of course, then, you know, I don't have any missteps associated with the Fantastic Four issue. The only misstep I have is probably the same you had, and that is a little bit of a faux pas with the art there from Sal Buscema there with the Nega bands acting all wonky and then showing up whenever they want to. That, like a Green Lantern power ring or something. They have a mind of their own.
Yeah, other than that, though, they're both awesome. They're both 5 out of 5. Tons of fun. No real missteps. They're both fun.
Yeah. So great two what-if issues. Now we're going to... Actually, now, since this Bronze Age Brilliance segment was so short and Mighty Marvel missteps, we're going to take a break now. But we'll be back in a jiffy to talk some shop talk. So don't go away, listeners. Stay with us.
stunning here?
We created a life.
You made her?
Yes. Dead pieces of this. My hands. I created what no man's mind or woman's womb could ever hope to achieve.
Blasphemy!
Blasphemy? Before what god? A god repulsed by the miserable humanity he created in his own image? I will not be shackled by the failures of your god. The only blasphemy is to wallow in insignificance. I have taken refuse of your god's failures, and I have triumphed. There is my creation.
All right, we're back with Shop Talk. Now, Billy, I don't know if you have anything for Shop Talk this week. I have two things that I want to mention. But first off, I'll give you a go. Do you have anything you want that's on your mind that you want to get off your chest?
No, I'm good. I know we were going to talk about the what if, though. Like, you had something to say about that. I can't wait to hear about that, though.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to recommend it again. But, of course, I've got some other what if related stuff that I want to mention on Shop Talk just for a bit of fun. But yeah, with regards to the What If show, which was the reason we decided to do this episode, I'm really enjoying it. I'm not going to say it's better than Loki or, you know, WandaVision or the Falcon and the Winter Soldier show, but it's a different kind of animal completely. You know, it's its own thing, and so far they've been killing it. I didn't like the Doctor Strange episode much, but right. But first let me get to that. Basically, the very first episode was What If Peggy Carter became Captain America? And they should have called her Captain Britain, you know, because she's British. But they didn't give her a name, really. She just, what if she became, you know, what if she had the super soldier serum? That was a fantastic issue. And I noticed something that I haven't seen people talking about much. It's almost as if since she was a healthy person, and not an emaciated little weakling like Steve Rogers was, it's almost as if her power level was up to She-Hulk-like levels. You know, so that made for some great animated action scenes. She hurled around some tanks. You know, she also had a shield courtesy of Howard Stark, because he also created an Iron Man-like suit for Steve Rogers in that. I hope I'm not spoiling anything here. I should like stop on the spoilers. This is going to be a spoiler free. But you know, that basically you can see that on the trailer as well. She teams up with this Iron Man in World War II. And I loved everything about this episode. That's still firmly my favorite episode of the bunch. And then the second one kicked off with what if T'Challa became Star-Lord? You know, with Yondu and the Ravagers picking up a young T'Challa in, you know, on safari or something. He's walking through the savannah there as a kid, and they pick him up and to become, you know, to go with them. And much like they picked up Peter Quill, they just picked up the wrong kid for some reason, you know. And you know, he became Star-Lord, and that's a great one too. I can't go into more because more would be spoiling, but basically it's a whole different universe up there with T'Challa as Star-Lord. A peaceful place.
Interesting.
And I would, I don't want to spoil too much. I almost mentioned who the big bad was. It's not Thanos, though, but the big bad is someone very interesting, someone we should have seen more of in the Marvel MCU in the movies. And then, you know, the third one was what if the Avengers never came to be, basically. What if the Avengers, the world's mightiest heroes, never... They were all, well, they were taken out there before they could form. And that's a very, very good episode as well, filled with twists, very action-packed. I enjoyed that too. And then we get to the Doctor Strange episode, which I enjoyed. But the Steven that you and I love, Billy, would never act like that. It's basically, what if Doctor Strange lost his heart instead of his hands?
Right.
Or scarred his heart instead of his hands. So, you know, he became basically... It's kind of like that old What If issue from Volume 1, What If Doctor Strange were a disciple of Dormammu. But in this case, it does not involve Dormammu at all. It's just Strange becoming I wouldn't say evil, just dark. You know, he starts to mess with the laws of reality and the universe in order to get back his lost love. Mm-hmm. Interesting, right? But I don't know. There's just something about it that rankled me. Like, would Strange really be that? I mean, we know that Doctor Strange in the MCU is prone to recklessness. We've seen that. But right. You know, I don't always like that. I mean, we've seen that on the recent Spider-Man trailer. Wong warned him, don't do that spell. And yeah, he still did it. Yeah, he's kind of reckless. But that kind of makes it fun in some cases, you know? Being that reckless. It worked in the Doctor Strange movie for me, but it didn't work in this What If episode. And also, I hate it when someone is presented as Steven's, you know, one and only love if it's not Clea. I mean, come on, Clea should be Steven's one and only. But, you know, they didn't do that. And then we get to a very disturbing episode, the most recent one, What If Zombies? And that was the latest one, right, Billy? That was a pretty good one, too. Very disturbing. Very disturbing. I can't go into too much spoilers, but yeah, it's basically a zombie virus from the quantum realm, you know, infected the heroes of the Marvel Universe at a critical point in their history, because Thanos was around, he was searching for the Infinity Stones, and then Earth still had the zombie nightmare to deal with. And there's some surprising characters who stepped to the front, who sort of formed this anti-zombie team, the Zombie Extermination Squad, comprised mostly of Avengers, but also characters associated with the Avengers. And a fantastic episode as well, but very disturbing. Mm. There's some scenes where you're like, oh my God, this is dark. This is definitely horror. You know, like for instance, my daughter's been watching What If with me. I wouldn't show that episode to her just because of some of the scenes in there. So yeah, very disturbing. So I would recommend that show. And because of that, obviously, you know, you and I, we're into What If now, briefly, for this week. But, Billy, I've got something for us that we can play around with. I came up with a list of What If, according to Into the Weird. So this is like What Ifs presented by Into the Weird, which would have been cool if Marvel used them. You know, they couldn't have used them on the TV show because you kind of have to be steeped in comic book knowledge to get most of them. But I'm going to run them down. And feel free to chime in when you want to. I'll have a bit of a pause after each one. If you want to, you know, if I say a what if and you find something that you want to say about that, like what would have happened in your mind, you feel free to mention whatever hops into your brain. So, buddy, are you ready for this, man? This is a list of, ooh, count them, 35 what ifs.
Wow.
Yeah, so Into the Weird presents. Number one, what if the Scarlet Witch fell for Ultron instead of the Vision? It could happen, Billy. Gosh. It could happen. Now, I got to mention, it starts off slow, but I'm building to the more disturbing ones later on in the list.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It could happen because she's got a thing for artificial constructs, right? Now, I don't know how this could have happened, but somehow Ultron might have been a good guy. Hypnotism, why not? Ultron's, he could easily do that. He hypnotized Hank Pym right after he was created. So,
Yep.
And we know that Ultron also seeks love in his life. I mean, Jocasta, you know, the bride of Ultron. Number two, Billy, what if Reed Richards sabotaged Victor Von Doom's experimental machine when they were students? So basically, what if Reed Richards was more of a bastard than Doom? Later on it would be revealed that the Thing actually, you know, Ben Grimm actually tampered with Doom's machine, and that's what caused the explosion that disfigured his face, right? But in this what if, it's basically what if Reed Richards was evil, he was jealous of Doom and it wasn't the other way around. So interesting, the whole Marvel universe might have been changed if evil Reed was Now here we get to a little bit of a touchy one. Number three, Billy, what if Jean Grey had a crush on Professor X?
The other way around.
That's right, but you know, it's still like creep. That I'm thinking we would have seen a Lolita, you know, kind of scenario in the Marvel Universe, which would have been terrible. You know, that could never happen. It would never have been allowed. But, you know, we know that there's these cringeworthy Silver Age panels where Professor X is, you know, lusting after young Jean, which is horrible.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, it's creepy.
Now we're gonna have to put that Sting song, Don't Stand So Close to Me, in here at some point. But very creepy. Professor X was a creepy guy, and then if Jean Grey had a crush, it was reciprocated. I don't know where it would have gone. Okay, number four. What if the radioactive spider had bitten Aunt May? Oh,
oh my.
We would have, I don't even want to think what would happen there. But let's just say that the Dr. Octopus would probably still have been her enemy. She would have taken him on. But it would have had a more, Catwoman Batman vibe between the two of them then. Okay, what if the next one, Billy. What if Gwen Stacy faked her own death?
Oh, then she maybe she did, and then that's when she slept with Norman. Oh wait, no, never mind.
Oh damn, you shouldn't have gone there. Peter was getting too clingy.
Didn't they just write a story where they retconned that out, like, and said that didn't really happen?
Yeah,
I thought I read something. Yeah, they did.
Thank
God.
That's horrible.
Oh Lord.
I don't want to contemplate that. But a lot of, you know, a certain kind of writer, you know, of a certain kind of mindset would have gotten a lot of story out of something like this. Okay, Billy, now, who hates magic the most in Marvel? Especially a character from the Hyborian Age that we all know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Conan. Conan hates magic. So the next one, what if Conan the Barbarian became the Sorcerer Supreme?
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine.
The writer who's going to tackle this story would really have to stretch he would really have to reach to get this story going. But interesting.
You need Don Glut on that one.
Oh yeah, come on Don. If he could make, you know, the Hulk story work, he could make this one work. Okay, Billy, number seven. What if Alicia Masters had a radar sense?
Oh my.
I'm telling you, she would have hooked up with our boy Daredevil. They would have been a duo, you know, the Daredevils.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting crime. Yeah. Poor Ben, again, he would have had, you know, been left in the dust, and he would have had to worry. You know, he was already had an inferiority complex based with, you know, the Silver Surfer showed up, you know, and started romancing Alicia.
Yeah.
All right, Billy, next one. What if the Me Too movement existed in the 60s and 70s and targeted Hawkeye? Huh?
No.
That could have happened, man. We know Hawkeye was harassing those ladies from the Avengers and the Defenders. The Me Too movement would have targeted him and given him hell. Rightfully so, because Hawkeye was a dog back then, right?
Oh, yeah. He was always trying to get with the ladies.
Definitely. All right, on to number 11. What if Daredevil became Mephisto's advocate? Huh? The devil's advocate?
That's crazy.
Daredevil became Mephisto's lawyer, basically. But also the devil's advocate. There you go. Daredevil could happen.
Hey, it might.
All right. Well, if ever Mephisto, you know, needs legal representation, I'm sure Daredevil would defend him if he thinks he's innocent. But also, it's possible. Okay, Billy, 12. What if Wolverine... This is something for our Canadian listeners out there. What if Wolverine fought in World War II as a Canadian super soldier called Captain Maple Leaf?
Wow.
We couldn't say Captain Canuck because that name's been taken. So I had to come up with another name. I think it's possible because Wolverine did fight in World War II, but what if it was part of a super soldier program from the Canadians? That would have been awesome. All right, Billy, closer to home here, closer to Into the Weird territory. What if Howard the Duck discovered he had superpowers under our yellow sun? Cue Super Duck. And he could have teamed up with Peter Parker. Yeah.
Spider-Ham.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we're injecting some DC here into Marvel. Now listen to this, Billy. This is definitely something that could occur. Number 14, what if Professor X and Moondragon were twins? Huh? Moondragon?
They're Professor both bald,
X?
Yeah.
They're twins. They both got telepathic powers. Come on, somehow that must have happened. You know, baby switching at the hospital. I don't know, but it happened. It probably definitely happened.
Could be.
Okay, number 15. Now we're getting into some Shang-Chi territory here, Billy. What if Fu Manchu was Wong's biological dad and not Hamir? You would have had two sons. Wong would take out his magical foes, and Shang-Chi would take out his political or, you know, espionage centered foes. Why not?
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, man. Then we get into the next one. What if Shang-Chi was sent to kill Doctor Strange instead of Doctor Petrie? What do you think about that one, Billy? I think Shang and Silver Dagger might have teamed up there.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but I think Silver Dagger is too much of a bigot or a racist to team up with Shang-Chi.
Yeah, for real.
Okay, Billy, what if Jocasta developed a fatal attraction to Rom? Jocasta started stalking Rom in the Marvel MCU. It could happen.
Oh, yeah. Getting a little love action going on there.
Bill Mantlo would have had a lot of fun with a story like that.
Oh, he would have loved it.
Okay, we're nearing the end of the list. Now we're going to run faster through these things. What if Bug from the Micronauts started stalking Mantis?
That's great.
Listen to this one, Billy. What if Nightcrawler was born in Germany in the 1920s and joined the Hitler Youth Movement?
Ooh, there you go.
That probably wouldn't have happened because of what he looked like. They would have shipped him off to the camps or something. Oh, but yeah. Hey, Hitler.
He didn't look good, so he wasn't a good-looking guy, so no.
He wasn't an Aryan superhuman-esque. But I think Hitler, if he spared him for some reason, he could have trained him to become a deadly assassin. You know, Churchill would have been assassinated. Bumf, dead Churchill. Bumf, dead, you know, Roosevelt. It could have happened. Okay, Billy, what if the symbiote costume possessed Fin Fang Foom? Basically, it would be game over. The entire Marvel universe would be toast.
Hell yeah, big dragon.
Yeah, dude, big giant symbiote dragon running around.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, that would have been creepy, man. Okay, number 22. What if Man-Thing discovered that he was merely a plant who copied the form of a man and never truly Ted Salas? What if he was... well, that's been done. That's been done over at DC. Listen, Billy, this is the answer to that question. He wouldn't have cared. Because the Man-Thing doesn't have a brain. He already thinks he was never Ted Salas. It doesn't matter. Okay.
Anyway, yeah, that didn't matter. You're right.
Now, a very, very conceivable one. What if Lady Sif murdered Jane Foster in a jealous rage?
Well, hey, that is possible.
That is very possible, my friend. I don't know why she didn't do it in regular continuity. Okay, Billy, now we've got a couple of good ones. What if Nightcrawler, you know, Nightcrawler, very religious. What if Nightcrawler was an atheist? And then we skip right to the next one. What if Daredevil was an atheist? And go right towards the next one. What if Thor was an atheist?
Oh, my gosh.
And the kicker, what if Odin was an atheist? They don't believe in themselves.
Yeah, wow.
All right, what if Morbius became a disciple of Dracula? Huh, Billy? What do you think about that? Morbius, a disciple of Dracula?
Could be.
Okay, Billy, now I know you're a big fan of this character. I don't know why I put him in here, simply for your benefit. What if V, from V for Vendetta, shaved Medusa from the Inhumans' head? As played by Natalie Portman, of course. Medusa, played by Natalie Portman in this role.
Yepper.
Ooh, V for Vendetta. We know how he likes to shave the heads off of girls, right? Okay, so what if Luke Cage was bitten by a radioactive pimp?
My goodness.
I got that off of... that's not my own original one, Billy. I got that off of a comic book called Aphrodisiac.
That's great.
Oh, it's great. There's also an origin story in Aphrodisiac which says, you know, Alan Diesler, a young man who discovered the magical pimp stick Mjolnir and transform into the godlike aphrodisiac by tapping the stick on the ground. Anyway, what if Luke Cage was bitten by a radioactive pimp? We might have had a different, you know, hero for hire. All right, yeah. What if Black Bolt talked in his sleep?
Oh no, we'd all be dead.
We'd all be dead. We'd all be dead, bro. Okay, now we're nearing the very end, Billy. We're nearing the very end. What if Alan Moore wrote the Fantastic Four? Now, what if Len Wein never got him over to write Swamp Thing? Yeah. What if Alan Moore wrote the Fantastic Four instead? Billy,
can you imagine?
There's a couple of things that could happen. Think about it. The Thing would have discovered that he's a pile of rocks that thinks it's a man. Very similar. Mm-hmm. Editor's note would have to be inserted here. See Swamp Thing. Franklin Richards' birth would probably have been a lot more graphic. So, editor's note, see Miracle Man. You know, we know Alan Moore likes to depict things step by step. And then Sue and Reed's sex life would have probably been shown in greater detail, especially the weird bits. And for an editor's note, you'll have to see all of Alan's collected works to reference this one. And, you know, Reed would probably have expanded his mind with some mind-altering substances. And for this editor's note, you'd have to see Alan Moore's teenage years.
Right.
He got expelled. Yeah. He got expelled from school for peddling what? Speed, was it? Or
something he shouldn't have been doing. Yeah.
LSD?
Probably.
And last but not least, that I had to insert here, since I'm an Alan Moore fan, Johnny Storm would have unknowingly emitted UV rays that gave his loved ones cancer, and he would have, you know, it would have not been public knowledge until a reporter like Ben Urich probably pointed it out, you know, in an interview. Right, very, yeah. Dr. Manhattan-esque. Now, Billy, the final one I've got for you, and you have to answer this what if. This is number 35. What if...
Okay.
One of the hosts of Into the Weird was Billy D. Williams instead of Billy Delicious. Answer me that, my friend.
We'd all be drunk on Colt 45 right now.
I knew you would say that. Uh-huh. We'd all be drunk on... Yeah. We would have a lifetime supply of Colt 45 to go with our podcasting.
Good beer.
Yeah, man. Not bad. And, you know, Billy, I wrote down a couple of options here. We'd be the fastest couple of hunks in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. We truly belong here among the clouds. The podcasting, you know, iClouds, I should say, where I store all the podcast episodes. But I guess, you know, other than that, you know, these podcasting deals that we subscribe to on Podbean would be getting worse all the time.
Yeah, you better believe it.
All Lando-isms. Plus, we'd be hitting on princesses. Not that there are any princesses.
Yeah.
So, but at least some couple of what-if scenarios. If Into the Weird were allowed to write the Marvel what-ifs, we'd be dealing with this kind of shenanigans. But that's not the end of our what-ifs, because we've got our recommendations of Ragador coming up. So stay tuned for that, listeners. Let's hear what Big D has to say for himself.
Greetings, mortal fools. Once again, it is I, Dormammu, taking over your airwaves, arresting your eardrums, subjecting you to my sheer awesomeness, straight from the Dark Dimension. I'm sitting here in the Dark Dimension dojo, high on Shang-Chi and martial arts, having just come from the IMAX theater. That's right, the Dark Dimension. We get the MCU films too. And of course, though I despise my portrayal in the Doctor Strange movie, which should have been called the Dormammu movie, I still like to sit back and chill and watch some MCU action. And the latest is one of their greatest, Shang-Chi. Of course, I rooted for the villains, or villain, as it were, but was disappointed that he was not Fu Manchu. probably the only human I admire. Still, we don't want to open up a can of racist representation here. So, it's probably better they did not go with that product from an old British white man's twisted mind. Still, I love the guy. This week, on the recommendations of Redditor, Billy brings something pleasing to my unfathomable mind. A story rendered in comic book form by one of my greatest and favorite authors, a certain Mr. King. While Herman betrays the entire podcast, it seems, by showing his love for an indie comic, which, the last time I checked, was not inspired by a Marvel property at all, but by a DC one. God damn him. I'll have him in the Dark Dimension soon for a session of endless torture. Still, read these books and give us some feedback on them and tell us whether we should kick host Herman off the show and get a new partner for Billy. Enjoy these recommendations if you can, and I will see you soon once Dormammu's fiery footprint again treads the earth.
Right, we're back with the recommendations of Ragador. Okay, Billy, you go first. What do you have for us this week on the recommendations?
All right, so you're going to love this one. And actually, I only got my hands on this one recently thanks to a good buddy of ours, Mr. Paul Hicks from Down Under.
Right.
He sent me Bizarre Adventures number 29 from 1981, starring Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man.
What? No, I've never read that. Never even seen that.
I'll have
crap,
to show
that's
it to
amazing.
You, oh, it's great. It's an adaptation of that Stephen King story, and it's by Walt Simonson. Oh, man, is it cool.
Holy God, dude, I got to read this. Okay, I got to track this down. I said I wouldn't buy more stuff over eBay, but I'm going to have to.
Yeah, I'll send you a few scans in the meantime, but oh, it's crazy. Well, you know that story. It's crazy.
Okay, yeah, no, I know. I mean, I know I've read the original, which is nothing like the movie. The movie with Pierce Brosnan is completely wackadoodle, right? It was crazy.
Yeah, no, they pretty much used the King adaptation because there's no writer credits at all. It's just a credit for Simonson doing the art, you know, so they take it, you know, in comic book form, obviously, but they take it and they do it justice, and oh, it's great. The guy with the lawnmower is, oh, man, it's great. You'll love it. I'll send you some
pictures. Wait a minute. So it is an adaptation of the Lawnmower Man, you know, story from Stephen King from Night Shift. It's got nothing to do with the movie, right? It was done, obviously, way back when, before the movie was even out. Yeah, because I think the movie came out in the early 1990s, right? So, okay, this would make sense. Okay, this would make sense.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man, that story is crazy. Like, when I first read it as a kid reading Night Shift, I thought, what is this? A guy with a lawnmower, and this lawnmower somehow telekinetically controls and then kills this dude. It's so mad, but yeah, it's Stephen King, man. Early Stephen King is the best Stephen King.
Yeah, it's insane. So there you go, seek that one out. what is it that you have, man?
Okay, I'm gonna recommend something I've been reading lately. You know, with the Suicide Squad movie and all of that, I got into my old Suicide Squad trades, but I'm not gonna recommend Suicide Squad. I'm going to recommend something that's like Suicide Squad, inspired by Suicide Squad, certainly. It's not Marvel, though. It's not related to, well, not by much. There is something of, you know, alternate dimensions in there, but it's not related to the multiverse at all. And this is Michael Fife's Copra. It's an indie comic. Billy, have you ever read Michael Fife's Copra?
No.
Have you even heard of it?
No, I never heard of this.
Okay, I've been reading it sporadically over the past couple of years. I first, you know, got introduced to it through, I think, listening to 11 O'Clock Comics, this podcast. And, you know, basically this is an indie artist, Michael Fife, and he's got a very loose style, but it's a very good style. I love the way he pencils and draws. I'll post some images, of course, on our web. And it's about a kind of Task Force X-like team who's sent on these missions. But, you know, they don't just stop with analogs of DC characters. Like, for instance, there's an analog of Deadshot in there, because Deadshot used to be part of the original Suicide Squad team and one of their more famous members, right? There's an analog of Deadshot in there and a couple of analogs of the other Suicide Squad members. But then they go into Marvel analogs as well. There's an analog of Doctor Strange in there. And there's a Clea character. And there are, you know, like, there's an Iron Man type character, you know, a teenage kid with his high-tech Iron Man suit. But they're all criminals, you know, who are drafted by the government to do, you know, basically their dirty work.
Yeah.
You know, they get sent on these assassination runs, and they do a lot of wet work. And it's just amazing. Now, his panels are not very detailed. You know, like I said, it's this indie style, but he draws in a very, this guy, Michael Fife, draws in a very fluid kind of way. So you got these Kirby style action panels, which flow very nicely. It's almost a little bit Frank Miller-esque, you know, when Frank Miller first started doing Daredevil, you know, it's that, those kind of action panels. A lot of silent action panels too, which we got from stuff like Lone Wolf and Cub, and you know, Larry Hama had that in G.I. Joe sometimes. Yeah. But Fife guy, dude, you'll have, for instance, you have 4 or 5 pages of just one battle, a fist fight between two characters, and it'll be the bloodiest mess you've ever seen. But it's fantastic because the action just flows. Minimal dialogue, of course, and but some great stories and some pretty scary situations too. Because after all, they're not hampered by, you know, any code. Not that DC was hampered by a code when they were doing Suicide Squad, but, you know, this is far bloodier because it's an indie comic. And I would recommend that. Michael Fife's Copra. You know, now, it sounds like I'm late to the party with this one because it's been out for a couple of years. There's multiple volumes in print of Copra. There's a Copra Compendium, which you can pick up. But, you know, I've been reading that for years and years. I just recently got into them again after watching the Suicide Squad movie and reading through my old John Ostrander Suicide Squad issues. And then I decided, hey, why not try Copra again?
Yeah.
Now, there's definitely some multiverse shenanigans in there, too. So it does tie in with our What If episode. So have a look at that. Yeah, Billy, you should also do that if you ever pick it up. Michael Fife's Copra.
Cool.
All right. Well, that brings us to our Allies of Agamotto segment. We're going to take a little bit of a break, insert a promo here, and then I'll ascribe a Bronze Age alter ego to one of our patrons. So again, listeners, bear with us. We'll be back in a few seconds.
Hey, Mike, have you heard about my new podcast?
Oh, what's that?
Oh, it's where you talk to people on your computer and then put it out on the internet.
Yes, I know what a podcast is, Paul, but what's the show you're doing?
Yeah, I'm going to talk to people on my computer and then put it out on the internet.
And what's this called?
Since it's a chat show and I really want to talk to interesting people about interesting things, I thought I'd call it something that was, you know, self-explanatory, like Dial F for Flanger.
Right. Dial F for Flanger. Cool. I look forward to my guest spot. When are you going to have me on?
I'll get back.
Wow. Well, if you'd like to hear Paul chatting away on this Dial F for Flanger show, you can find it on the Waiting for Doom Network.
All right, Weird Ones, it's time for our Allies of Agamotto segment, where we ascribe a Bronze Age alter ego, a superhero moniker, to one of our listeners and supporters this time around. It's Mr. Brian Hansen. He has recently become a supporter of ours on Patreon, and since he's one of our first patrons, the time has come to finally bestow upon him his very own Bronze Age superhero alter ego. All right, Brian, since we sent you a questionnaire and you completed it, I'm not going to share all the answers on there. Some of them were pretty weird because, after all, we're into the weird. But I will share the weirdest thing that's ever happened to you. Apparently, you won the first place in the Minnesota State Yo-Yo competition. I tried to work a yo-yo into your origin, but I just couldn't do it. It's just too. It wouldn't have gelled with what I came up with here. So, but Brian's also a guitarist of note. He's a musician, and he loves all things Marvel. One of his favorite Spider-Man villains, in fact, is Morbius. And Morbius is, in fact, one of my favorite superhero characters. So villain, yes. He definitely straddles the line between villain and hero, old Michael Morbius does. So, Brian, I hope you like what we came up with here for you. Without further ado, let's hit it. When Stan Lee and the members of the rock group Kiss traveled to Marvel's printing facility outside of Buffalo, New York, in 1977... to have their blood drawn by a registered nurse under the watchful eye of a notary public, they never dreamed that that batch of blood, intended to be mixed with the ink that would be used to print the first issue of Kiss's very own Marvel comic, would lead to the birth of one of the most feared Marvel superheroes of them all, the sinister spirit of vengeful strumming, Brian Hansen, a.k.a. The Ghost Rocker. It all went down one chilly evening when Brian, a young security guard at the Buffalo Marvel printing facility, caught sight of some ne'er-do-wells stealing into the building. Hugging the shadows, they seemed ill-suited to activities requiring stealth, and Brian, stealing closer, soon identified them as DC staffers that he had kicked off the premises once before. Foiled in their previous attempt at sabotage, they stupidly tried their luck again, but Brian was more than ready for them. Leaping from around a corner with a baton in hand and about to open up a can of serious whoop-ass, Brian was confronted by only three men, though he remembered there being a fourth. Pain suddenly exploded in his head as the fourth man jumped him from behind, laying Brian out with a length of pipe. All became darkness. Until 10 minutes later, when Brian awoke to see four figures scurrying away from the facility. One of them was clutching a glass container in his hand, filled with some dark liquid. As they ran towards the parking lot, Brian could make out some of what they yelled to each other.
Move it, Carmine, you fat son of a... I'm doing the best I can, Kenninger. You shut your hole.
As they hopped in their getaway car, Brian sprang into action. He ran towards his own mode of transportation, a Harley-Davidson XR750, a bike he had spent every last penny of his inheritance to purchase. It was at times like these when the adrenaline flowed and a red cloud dimmed his vision that Brian felt most alive. Rock music blasted into his head, as it always seemed to do when he was excited, and the rumble of the Harley filled his ears as he goosed it into life. He set off after the thieves, not caring what they stole, but intent on turning this night into their very own private hell. The chase took them into the heart of New York City, and as Brian started closing the gap, the old farts became increasingly desperate. Losing control of the vehicle, they crashed into the lobby of an Oscorp research lab, mangling the front desk and the guard on duty in the process. Brian arrived amidst the carnage to see three of the dastardly old-timers unconscious in their wreck of a car, but the fourth making a beeline for the elevators, still clutching the stolen flask in his hands. Hopping off his bike, Brian ran up the nearest stairwell. Fit due to his long hours as a security guard and headlining for indie bands on weekends, Brian bounded up the stairs, finally exiting on the top floor, having guessed correctly that this was where his quarry would flee. Just as the old man came out of the elevator, Brian took him down with a spectacular flying tackle, exultantly yelling the words, "Your ass is mine, Weisinger!" As the old man's body crumpled beneath the weight of Brian's 200-pound frame, the flask of liquid, which, unbeknownst to him at the time, contained the mixed blood of the members of KISS, went flying through the air, caroming off a control panel, activating a sadistic radiation chamber used thus far only for animal testing. The flask opened, spilling its contents all over the control panel, causing the chamber to malfunction and to spew forth dangerous gobs of radioactive matter. Finally, the entire lab exploded, spattering the rest of the building with radioactive dust and irradiated rock band blood. Brian awoke amidst the carnage and flames, and as he staggered to his feet, he found himself facing four monstrous figures. They were, he somehow instinctively knew, Mort the Demon, Catman Kaniger, Starchild Swartz, and Carmine the Spaceman, a troop of evil born from Rockstar blood, radiation, and the gutted corpse of the Oscorp lab. Glancing to his left, Brian was shocked to see his own body lying under a ton of masonry. Was he then dead? The thought filled his disembodied form with rage and a need for immediate and extremely violent vengeance consumed him. Hard rock tunes started pounding through his ghostly brain, and he was thrilled to see his disembodied soul, or whatever it was, enveloped in a coat of radioactive flame. A Fender Starcaster electric guitar suddenly appeared in his hands, made of living fire. He plucked the strings, and miniature musical supernovas flared in the air around him. Striding back to his body, he merged with it, reanimating it, healing it, becoming infinitely stronger. Getting to his feet, the masonry fell from him like paper mache, and he faced his doomed foes. Snarling, they attacked with all their hellish radioactive power, but Brian was unfazed. Manifesting a pick, he launched into an epic solo that blasted the skin off their bones and shredded their souls to metaphysical ribbons. When the last note faded, Brian stood alone amidst the rubble. Vengeance had been served. And it had been served hot. From that day on, Brian Hansen was Brian Hansen, the security guard, no longer. He started living a strange double life, playing in bands and on session recordings whenever the gigs presented themselves, but seeking out evil in all its forms at night as the vengeful rocker of radioactive fire. He entered the Marvel superhero scene like a bullet through a brain and jackhammered his way through continuity, coming into contact and conflict with everyone from the Abomination to Zarko the Tomorrow Man. He soon established his own rogues gallery of eerie foes. Enemies like Jimmy Haldrix, the Ungrateful Dead, Ozzy Stillborn, and the forgotten 90s pop band Hanson, who have a mad-on for Brian, who eclipsed them in popularity and who, at least in their minds, stole their name and ultimately their fame. But that, as they say, is a tale for another day. So let's hear it for Brian Hansen, the flame-generating, finger-picking phenomenon, the dreadlock, hard-rock, volcanic, crop-top-wearing warlock, the super solo-riffing sensation. Give it up for the man who tamed the living flame and turned it into fiery musical mayhem. Brian Hansen, everybody, the guitarist now known as the Ghost Rocker. And that's it, Brian, your Into the Weird superhero moniker. I hope you like it. I just had a bit of fun with it. And I don't even know if you're into rock music, but who isn't into rock music? And you might absolutely hate the band KISS, but, you know, they didn't fare so well in your origin story. So if you hate them, hey, I think that's okay as well. All right, Billy, that's it for another Into the Weird. We just want to thank everybody who's been supporting us on and been retweeting our stuff, especially our Twitter compadres. You know, it's also always fun when we get up to Twitter shenanigans. And, you know, you and I were constantly on Twitter. But we also want to give a big shout out to our patrons and then also promote our Patreon a little. Folks, if you want to support Into the Weird, check out our Patreon site, which is at www.patreon.com/ Into the Weird. And Billy, what do we have there to offer the listeners? We've got three tiers. You could just subscribe for as low as, you know, our $1, which is just a, you know, you just support Into the Weird and we'll give you a shout out, of course. But we've also got the $5 tier and the $10 tier. What do they get if they subscribe to the $5 and $10 tier?
Yeah, so the $5 tier, you know, you get three more shows every month, which are The House of Licensed Ideas, Dragons and Jive, and Radio Free Hyboria, and tons of content there, you know, more kind of along the lines of Into the Weird stuff, but really cool, you know, 70s stuff that everybody will just absolutely go ape over. And then for the $10 tier, again, you get all that stuff, and then you get your Bronze Age alter ego and a care package.
That's right. That's right. So we've had a couple of patrons almost reaching the 3 month mark, and they're about to get their care packages. And I've already gearing up getting the Bronze Age alter egos ready. And if you've already received the Bronze Age alter ego because you left us a 5-star review on iTunes in the past, you'll get another one, a different one, a totally different one that I'll ascribe to you. So I'm looking here at people like Slangword Scott. You know, he's on our $10 tier and he's, you know, up for a second Bronze Age alter ego, which I'm cobbling together for him. So yeah, fun times. Then, of course, Billy, just to speak more on the shows on offer there, we've got Dragons and Jive, like you said, which chronicles Shang-Chi. You know, we're doing all of his original Bronze Age comics, and we're doing Iron Fist and Power Man, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and eventually we'll do Power Man and Iron Fist when we get to that on our Dragons and Jive episode. And everybody's loving the Shang-Chi, you know, recently with the success of Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, the movie being a huge blockbuster. And then, of course, Radio Free Arborea, we're talking Conan the Barbarian, King Kull, Red Sonja, various Howard-related properties. And then, of course, we've got House of Licensed Ideas, which is, wow, the scope of that is so vast. But at the moment, we're doing the licensed properties that Marvel had. ROM, we're doing Micronauts, Godzilla. We're going to do Planet of the Apes. We're going to do John Carter, Warlord of Mars. Indiana Jones, Star Wars, you know, a variety of other stuff that we've got planned. So, yeah, if you want to support us and listen to some extra Into the Weird content, please do so over at patreon.com. All right, Billy, so where can they reach us if they want to send some feedback?
Yeah, so if you want to reach out to us on social media, I'm at Billy D. Licious. You know, I can reach out to me there or DM or whatever. And, you know, the show is at Into Weird. And where are you at?
Yeah, I'm at Dark Longbox on Twitter. And we're also, you know, you can send us DMs at all of our accounts. And you can also send an email straight to syncintotheweird@gmail.com, and we'd be glad to read that on the show. And, you know, even suggestions, right, Billy? We'll take suggestions and we'll incorporate that into upcoming episodes, and we love that. We love it if you listeners participate and you know, give us some, you know, what you want to hear. And we're going to do that soon in the form of polls on our Patreon as well. So for the patrons, they'll have polls where they can actually pick upcoming episodes, so look forward to that. But before we go, Billy, we'll leave the listeners with a little bit of a message. Stay cool, stay frosty, you know. Remember, what if things were worse? Always think about that. If your life seems troubled, think about a what if scenario where there could really be zombies running around chewing, you know, on our brain. So yeah, I'm always looking on the bright side and the weird side. You can't go wrong with things getting weird. So stay weird, listeners. That's what we're trying to impart to you here. And then things should be turn out fine. Hopefully.
For sure.
Okay, so with that, I'm out of here. That's bye from me.
All right, stay weird, everybody.
Cheerio.